anything that we do, it's going to go so much farther if we do it together versus ourselves. And it's very tempting as airlines, you know, and we of course do it as well. We're so excited to be like, JetBlue is doing this and alone. But I think the customers and the public sort of looks at airlines holistically and they make a judgment around, are we good actors? Are we bad actors? And obviously, you know, they like the experience and other, you know, and have loyalty to different brands, of course. But I think when you think of it from an environmental standpoint, it's sort of like we're sort of one sort of mass of like good or bad. And so he really helped me think like, truly, you know, how do we break down some of these barriers and how do we do things together? Because that's what people are noticing, not like, oh, JetBlue's incrementally better than, you know, some other airline.
Welcome to Sustainability in the Air, the world's first podcast dedicated to sustainable aviation. I'm your host, Shashank Nigam, the CEO of Simply Flying. Every Thursday, I have important conversations with top aviation executives, technology entrepreneurs, and policymakers helping aviation take climate action. Conversations that help separate the signal from the noise. Whether you are a frequent flyer or an airline executive, if you care about sustainability or simply love traveling, welcome aboard. This season of Sustainability in the Air is brought to you by Travelport. Travelport is a global technology firm that powers bookings for hundreds of thousands of travel suppliers worldwide. The company's travel retailing marketplace, Travelport Plus, helps retailers understand and communicate the most sustainable options. When it comes to sustainability in travel, it can be difficult for travelers and agents to identify which flights, routes, and accommodations are the greenest. That's why Travelport empowers its agents to operate as modern retailers of sustainable travel, giving them the ability to access consistent emissions data using the travel impact model. Travelport is also exploring solutions to help travel retailers offer carbon compensation and nature regeneration to their customers. My guest today is Sarah Bogdan, the head of sustainability and ESG at JetBlue Airways. Sarah is one of those rare guests I've had on the podcast who have a whole career in sustainability. Sarah graduated with a degree in environmental earth science from University of California, Berkeley, went on to do her master's in environmental management at Duke University, and since then has spent a full career spanning Walmart, UCLA, and then JetBlue, where she has been for almost a decade, I think now, looking after sustainability. She was manager of sustainability and now is the head of sustainability as well. Sarah has set some very tough targets for JetBlue in achieving net zero. In fact, it is going to be one of the first airlines in the world to achieve net zero in 2040. Not 2050, you heard that right, it's 2040. I deep dive with Sarah on how exactly she plans to get there, how she rolls up her sleeves and puts JetBlue on a sustainable path forward. Enjoy this conversation. Sarah, welcome to Sustainability in the Air. Congratulations on becoming one of the first airlines in the world to have a net zero 2040 goal. I don't think there's any other airline that is there yet, at least in North America. My first question, you know, you announced this net zero program, the targets validated by SBTi. Can you talk us through the main elements of how you are getting to net zero by 2040?
Sure. Well, first, thank you, of course, for inviting me to speak and for helping us share JetBlue's story. Maybe before I get to the how, I'll talk a little bit about our net zero commitment and maybe how we got there. So interestingly, it was actually in 2020, when the very end of the year, but when we announced our net zero commitment, and we did this via signing the Amazon had co-founded this climate pledge, and it was this growing collection of businesses committing to achieve net zero by 2040, which is, of course, 10 years ahead of the Paris Agreement, and 2050, which is what the majority of our industry has focused on. And I like to sort of pause on the fact that it was 2020. I think that when we think about 2020, obviously we think about the like massive impact from the pandemic and we weren't flying anywhere. But despite all of that, for us, even though unprecedented year in the airline industry, and we had to stop flying a whole lot. We actually had a whole lot of sustainability accomplishments, right? The release of this, also we started flying regularly using SAF or sustainable aviation fuel, a couple of other wins as well. So I'm really proud of that in our history. And I'll also give a shout out to Alaska Airlines. You know, we're all friends in the industry. They also signed on to the climate pledge. So they are another airline with the same ambitious target as us. And in our view, you know, why did we do this? Well, first, we were one of the first airlines to commit to net zero. So at that time, we didn't know we were going to be 10 years ahead of all the other airlines who came in later at 2050. But it's something we still absolutely think is the right strategy, especially in light of the IPCC assessment report that just came out where, you know, we're sort of not on track globally to meet the goals of the Paris Agreement. And there was this calling that we need to do more and faster. My personal opinion is that we're all going to have to sort of move up to 2040 and I'll have to accelerate our work. And, you know, we certainly never knock any other airline strategy. We have a different footprint and a different set of opportunities. We actually maybe have a little bit easier to decarbonize here in the U.S. because we have a regular SAF supply and diverse set of producers, and we're flying on it today and a lot more announced. So for us, it seemed like the right thing to do. And it's not just my opinion. It's that of our CEO and senior leadership team that, you know, push yourself as far as you can, because if you don't set that ambitious goal, you're most certainly not going to get there.
You know, before you actually get into the how, I'm very intrigued. Initially, I was going to ask you, why did you stick your neck out and say, we'll be the first ones in 2040 and not just follow the rest of the industry and IATA saying 2050? Now, I just heard you say, the rest of the airlines should be doing this by 2040, 2045 as well. Do you think they will?
And I'm not necessarily saying that they should. I think that our industry, and we were a big part of the discussions through IATA at our Global Trade Association, where we had to get all of the 300 or so airlines to agree to this. And then also the similar discussions here in the U.S. through we've made collective commitments to achieve net zero as an industry by 2050. And I think that's the right thing. Look, it does, like, as an industry, it aligns with the needs of the Paris Agreement. That said, JetBlue is going to be JetBlue, right? We're always going to try to push ourselves a little bit farther. And I do think that probably every airline and every business will have to, as time goes on, take a step back and reevaluate their targets. I do totally acknowledge, though, that for all of us, so much of it is uncertain. And so that was a scary part in this commitment, in our science-based target commitment, in our, you know, which is for 2035 and a 2030 commitment. Like, we know we're going to do everything we can, but we still don't know exactly what the technology and supply will be available for us to get there.
Right, of course. So now let's get into the how. How are you going to get there ahead of everyone else?
Yeah, look, I do love to point to our sort of wedge graph, the pathways chart that we released back in December, because we put a lot of data behind it. And it looks like a pretty graph, but basically it shows sort of where emissions would go over time for JetBlue. And this is all assuming JetBlue as an entity by itself. Anything pertaining to Spirit would be reanalyzed post-merger. But the idea is, where would our emissions go if we did absolutely nothing? I mean, we sort of froze aviation technology where it is today, had no more SAF in our operation. Planes never got more efficient, right? We never had an electric plane. We don't think this is going to happen, but how bad emissions could get with our intended growth. And then we have these little segments that say, well, this is what each lever or solution is going to reduce. And if you look at that, it paints a pretty clear picture that especially out to 2040, out to 2050, sustainable aviation fuel or SAF is going to be about half of the puzzle, right? I could talk about SAF for a very, very long time, but rather than get distracted for this moment, obviously we have a long way to go in terms of ramping it up in our operation. I'd say the next key contributor is around changes to fleet, whether it's just incremental changes and improvements from existing planes, or some airplanes of the future. That's sort of the next big lever. And then operations really can't be understated. You know, JetBlue will do everything we can internally to make sure that we're introducing new technologies to improve fuel efficiency, not wasting a drop of fuel in the air, and making sure our own crew members are following the procedures. But we also have a specific call out to the role of air traffic control modernization. They are real contributors that overall get us to the goal that we're working toward.
Fantastic. I mean, thank you for the overview. I want to dig a little into one of the components there, which is that 26% will be accounted by
next generation fleet and aircraft. Do you mean more fuel efficient versions of the existing aircraft? So the A320 XLR or the Neo or the A220? Or are you saying like EasyJet, hydrogen aircraft? Or are you saying like Air New Zealand, electric aircraft? Where is this 26% coming from?
Yeah, and thank you. And we can actually, I'm going to speak to it and then we can further clarify. I started to say this, like truly this graph was the outcome of this massive model that we put together that across multiple teams at JetBlue, literally input, like these are every single airplane that we have. This is what our network team thinks we're going to, like how we're going to grow. And then also what are our assumptions around available technology? And the fleet one is obviously one that's a little bit outside of our control. That's a lot outside our control in that today JetBlue doesn't make airplanes. But maybe just to simplify it. So the 8% that I can see that's out for 2050, and I do have a version of this that goes to 2035 and 2040 if you'd like those numbers, but on the numbers you see on this chart are to 2050. That is the existing generation. So I think, you know, to what you said around like just incremental improvements in technology and material and design for the Airbus that we're flying on today, for example, for the Neo, like we see about what 20% or so improvement in fuel efficiency just from these incremental changes to existing aircraft. And that's what it says existing generation. The 26% actually doesn't include hydrogen or electric, as you might think. We actually worked closely with our JetBlue Ventures team and chose for the purpose of this to exclude it from this analysis. Hopeful that we're wrong, but acknowledging that our operation, and there's a lot of uncertainty that we don't know if we are going to have like sort of large electric or hydrogen aircraft, hoping we do, of course, but we didn't build it into these assumptions. And so the 26% actually refers to just new generation of aircraft that haven't been built, haven't been delivered, are increasingly fuel efficient, have new types of engines, et cetera. We've seen some cool designs from the different OEMs, so we're hopeful that those materialize.
The interesting thing is, if it is indeed new aircraft, new types that have not been developed, how are you going to get there? Are you doing an RFP? Are you doing something like what Air New Zealand is doing? Come all the electric aircraft suppliers, let's do something. Or what EasyJet is doing, let's say with Rolls-Royce and developing the hydrogen engine, for example?
Yeah. So I think maybe I'd separate them into the next generation of aircraft for existing. So maybe for the existing sort of for the existing aircraft and the improvements, I will say that we are extremely vocal with Airbus, who is, you know, soon to be, once we retire all of the Embraer, the E190s are sort of key, our one partner in terms of manufacturing aircraft. And I think we consider it our job as a customer to continue to say, we want this, we expect this. In terms of the electric and hydrogen, I think our approach, it's similar with them, but I think really well evidenced in our work with JetBlue Ventures. And I know you're having the conversation with them if you haven't already, but something I'd like to point out is that I think it was 2016 that they were founded. And from the beginning, sustainability was one of the core investment themes. And so we have been looking at this for a very long time. Early investor, of course, in Joby. And so our approach is, I guess we haven't quite done an RFP. I haven't done an RFP personally, but they, our view is, how do we find the most promising technologies after thorough due diligence? And then how do we accelerate them, right? So obviously the investment is a part of it. But the other part that I think is unique and brings me into the picture more is around access to us. Like, what's unique is that we run an airline. We have 25,000 people right now who work here and who know how, like, what it's like, what the needs are, what it's like at the airport, what our pilots are saying. And so we offer them that support to any of our portfolio companies to help them be as successful and hopefully maybe one day find their way into our operation.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I mean, this is already very insightful for myself and the listeners as well. Let's talk a little about offsetting here. That is playing a decreasing role as we progress to 2040 in net zero plans. But are you currently still automatically offsetting some or all of your flights? To what extent will this play a role going on in the future? And what about carbon capture?
Brilliant question. So apparently I love this chart because I'm just going to point out one thing on it again. If you're looking at it, you'll notice the gray, and that is the role that carbon offsets and removals are expected to play. And the gray, you know, you'll see that up until the end of 2022, we were buying a whole lot of carbon offsets. So we launched this back in 2020. At the time, it was the best tool that we had since we didn't have any access to supply yet. And we wanted to do something big because we knew customers and our stakeholders cared. And this is what we had before us to really do something big. So we began voluntarily offsetting all of our domestic emissions, becoming one of the biggest voluntary carbon offsetters in the world, and also doing this in a way that made sure that we had a high degree of due diligence. We sourced credits from three different partners, for which we tried to find as many projects that they were developing themselves. So we felt that these were like high integrity, high quality, legitimate carbon offsets. But as you see in the graph, we have chosen to end the program, and I'll speak to why, but the little gray bit never disappears. So that is purposeful. We still are buying much fewer, but we are still buying some voluntary carbon offsets today. And maybe starting with the announcement we had in December, and it was, again, very comprehensive, lots of pieces to it. But for us, again, when we began offsetting all of our domestic emissions, as I said, it was the best tool that we had. We are fortunately at a place where the context has changed. We now have two supply agreements delivering SAF in our operation. We have another one we just announced. We have World Energy and Neste delivering into San Francisco and LAX. We just announced a deal with Shell, bringing more SAF to LAX. And then we have three so far, many more to come, future SAF agreements for tons and tons of supply. And so we've realized that the world of sustainable aviation is closer than it was. And the time was now to really take all of our investments and funds that we were putting into offsets and just sort of redirect them into SAF. That's right. We wanted to play our role in making sure that this market reached commercial scale and that the price came down, right? The more that we buy, ideally economies of scale are achieved, you know, more demand and ultimately get to this place where the price can come much closer to the price of conventional jet fuel. So that's something that we announced, and I think it was sort of understandable and well received. I think the piece that we like to also clarify, though, is that despite this shift, we think at the end of the day, to reach our goals, we're going to require some degree of offsetting, some degree of compensation. And that's reflected in the graph, of course. I mean, we will do everything we can, but there is a lot that's outside of our control and a lot of technology that needs to scale and a lot of government action that needs to happen and a lot of action from the investment community and making these big projects come online. There's just a lot from different angles that we don't think... We think that will require some degree of carbon offsets. We'd like them to be as small as possible. Completely agree on that. But if we sit back and do absolutely nothing now, if we hit 2040, say, when our net zero commitment hits, or even 2050, if I'm a different airline, and if we've done nothing to help mature and grow the offsetting market and make sure that those are legitimate and truly achieving the emissions reduction that they're supposed to, and growing it and making sure they're affordable, then we won't have anything left. It won't be there for us. So we think it's our role to do both. And that's why we have not stepped out of it. Instead, our position has been, well, let's solve some of the problems. Because we agree, like, there have been some legitimate concerns around some lower quality carbon offsets that aren't producing anything additional, that aren't being verified. And that's obviously not our goal. We want a flourishing market of, you know, true removals and high integrity carbon credits.
Thank you once again. I appreciate the reasoning you're giving for lowering it. One little nuance that is unknown to most is JetBlue auto offset flights. When you were buying carbon offsets, you did not ask passengers to voluntarily do so. Now, given the cost of SAF is 3 to 6 times more than cost of jet fuel, are you passing this cost of additional SAF to the customers? Or is JetBlue going to cover this green premium, as Bill Gates likes to call it as well?
Yeah, so as of now, we are not passing the cost along. And the reason we were offsetting all of our domestic emissions, we felt it was our responsibility to do on behalf of the customer, right? For those who were traveling, we wanted to take away this concern around climate guilt. And so we have, I want to talk to a couple programs we've recently rolled out where customers can contribute to buy more SAF. But all of the SAF that's, you know, we started with in our operation, you know, was sourced by JetBlue, was funded by JetBlue, and something we do on behalf of the customer. That said, we've rolled out programs for corporate customers and now for individual customers who want to do more. Totally voluntary, right? We're not adding this as a sort of fee to the ticket at all, but rather if for those who, I mean, it's we definitely see it for corporate customers who have their own net zero targets. individual customers, some just really care and they want to be able to add a couple more dollars to help, you know, further the sustainable the SAF market. And so we've put together those programs to make it easy for them, where essentially through our corporate customer program and our individual customer program, we have dedicated funds that we sort of guarantee only go to SAF procurement. And that's been actually huge in helping us buy more and more SAF.
Wow. I think it's a very enlightened approach. A lot of airlines are trying to check the box to say, we are offering offsets, we are offering SAF, but then customer, you please pay for it. And with a 1% take-up rate, I don't think that's working, to be honest, right now. 51%, that's the number you have as a SAF, sustainable aviation fuel target in 2040. Where is this SAF going to come from? You mentioned World Energy and Neste. How about someone like Air Company? You have that agreement. Do you foresee Air Company providing a lot of this SAF going forward and others like them?
Yes, of course. We love Air Company. They're one of our, we've got six SAF deals today. And I mean, we're also extremely transparent with where we've made so much progress, nearly doubling our sort of SAF in our operation every single year. I could probably go back and validate that because it might be on a percent basis. So this year, by the way, so I think you probably will say somewhere in your book that at the time of this, you know, research, what, we're at 0.1%, you know, globally is SAF. Maybe it's gone up, hopefully, I don't know. But we're targeting about 0.5, over a half a percent this year. I will say on a blended basis, on around a 30 or so percent blend. So it's still a very small number. Like we, obviously, half a percent. It's much higher than the industry average, which we're proud of, but we have so, so much more to do. And we have interim goals, of course. Our 2030 target is the 10% SAF goal. We've sourced probably about over six or so percent of it, so we have more to do. But Air Company, I think is slightly farther out. I forget, maybe we said 2027 or whichever year. We were also transparent in the timing of when we first announced was an MOU. So we acknowledged, look, there's sort of at the time they were in the development process, we see so much opportunity and we would love that SAF in our operation. But we're going to finalize some of the commercial deal, including really where the SAF's going to go and exactly how much. I think just once they're like closer to commercial production.
Thanks for clarifying that these are MOUs and intentions to buy, not necessarily contracts right away. And that does make sense. Now, one of the interesting things about JetBlue is it's growing as an airline. You launched Amsterdam, Europe, Paris, you're increasing frequencies to London. And these are all, I would say, medium haul destinations, not necessarily flying from Boston to New York, which was my old home. And hence, you know, the JetBlue route I used to fly most often. How do you as an airline, and you especially leading sustainability, reconcile growth in overall emissions because of flying more with the need to remain sustainable? I mean, you've got, you know, you say your target is 0.5% for SAF, nowhere close to 30, 40, 100%. How do you reconcile this growth overall with sustainability goals?
Honestly, I feel great about it. So, I mean, to sort of to point to the question that I wasn't supposed to see, right? JetBlue is my favorite airline. And look, I genuinely believe a bigger JetBlue is better for the industry because I see that we're industry leading in so many ways, right? We have our more ambitious net zero commitment. We are one of just a couple airlines globally that have committed to a science-based target. And I do believe, though I can't see everyone's data, I do believe that we are industry leading on SAF as a percent of our fuel, not on a volume basis, and that we're just a little bit smaller. So I actually think that when we're bigger, it's going to be great in that we, of course, are just going to double down on all of our commitments. I believe that air travel is so important to society, and I'm sure that you do also, or you wouldn't be in the line of work that you're in. It's so important, and we all reflect back in 2020 when we all had to cancel our trips, work, personal, and it was very, very painful. Air travel is such a good thing for society, right? And bringing people together, allowing you to explore the world. And I believe, from the JetBlue perspective, that we should have, you know, high quality and affordable air travel. That said, we have a problem, a sustainability problem, and that has to be solved. So my view is, let's not say let's stifle growth and fly less. Let's solve this problem at hand. Let's allow us to grow and let's get to this. Like, I can't wait to the future state when it is 2040, when it is 2050, and we have sort of a robust and larger airline allowing people to explore the world, but we have dramatically reduced the impact that goes with it today.
So that's interesting. Let's debate this a little bit more here. Now, the IPCC report said we have to take action urgently. Airlines currently are anywhere from 2 to 3% of total carbon emissions, excluding non-CO2 emissions. If you continue to grow at the rate aviation is growing, while other industries like cars and steel are lowering their emissions, we have, you know, aviation can potentially become up to 20% of total emissions by the end of the year if we continue growing unabatedly, right? So how is that making the social aspect of flying more important than the environmental aspect of flying on the ESG spectrum?
I would argue, so first of all, I would say that as an industry, we have achieved emissions improvements over the last couple of years. I will say some of the COVID data is hard to sort of take out some of the noise. And I can follow up with some of it specifically, but it's on the order of like a 10% reduction per seat. So we are improving, we are trending in the right way. What I would argue is agreed, we need to do things more urgently. So let's accelerate all of the technologies and the solutions that we have identified. Like SAF isn't this like futuristic maybe thing that's going to exist. Like it exists today. We're flying on it today. The problem is we have so little of it. So we have been extremely vocal as an industry to say, well, we need a lot of things just to make more of it, right? We need more government incentives to help us just temporarily get this price premium down and then eventually go away. We don't want it to be subsidized forever. We need more projects. We need like other fuel producers to start turning their attention more to SAF. So that's my argument. I would say let's allow us to keep with our sort of, you know, year over year, fairly modest, honestly, growth plans. But let's rapidly accelerate SAF because in the U.S., we have this 3 billion gallon SAF goal through the White House, the SAF Grand Challenge, that we have a lot of work to do. And so, like, that's what I would say is the airlines, like, we know how to get there. We've been very vocal about what we need. And so it's just making sure that every single partner, every single stakeholder is truly doing everything they can.
Right. I remember, of course, I agree that a larger JetBlue specifically is good for industry as a whole, because we learn a lot from everything from your A321 cabin innovations and the design to, of course, now how you are leading the way 10 years ahead of the industry on sustainability. Everyone is watching you in Alaska, for example, in this case. Let's talk a little about passenger experience. If I am to fly JetBlue today, what are some of the aspects inside the cabin I will notice that are sustainable?
Absolutely. So it's funny. We talk so much about emissions first, right? We're an airline. That's what people think of. Something that we also think about, though, is like customers can't see SAF. So it's always been a hard thing to communicate. We do, you know, and I promise I'll transition in some of the product stuff and some of the waste initiatives we have. But we have, first of all, we've put a lot more messaging on board around the work that we're doing in environmental and fuel emissions reduction. So first of all, you should hopefully see that. Actually, this month, you'll also see a video that showcases myself, Robin, our CEO, and then our SAF partner, Neste, through the Climate Pledge, and Amazon kindly helped organize the whole video. It's really, really well done, actually done by a Sundance winning director, and it's on board. So we're trying to tell the story. We're trying not to overstate sort of where we are and so all the work that we have to do. But we're definitely, first of all, putting that front and center. But, you know, as I said, like, customers can't see SAF. They can't really see emissions. And so that's something that I think many customers don't notice at first. So we've also done a lot from the product perspective. Maybe I'll start with waste. Interestingly, I think that JetBlue has one of the first sustainability programs. And it was over, I want to say 11 or 12 years ago when my predecessor first came in. And the program was launched to set up an onboard recycling program, specifically at first. You know, it was a different world, a little bit less pressure and a little bit less technology available to us. But it was something that both our own crew members and our customers was like very obvious to them. And, you know, one of the things that's special about JetBlue is we always give you sort of the unlimited snacks. And at the time, like the full can, which we still do, of soda. And I think we transitioned, but it used to be like a full water bottle, which is stuff that everyone knows is recyclable. And at the time, we didn't have the system in place to recycle because there's a lot of work that goes into setting up the operations at an airport and making sure that we're sorting and then getting it to the recycling facilities. And so it was basically the reason we created the team in the first place. And so that's a program that still exists today. And early on, we have had that our policy, where feasible, because sometimes turbulence or other sort of short flight issues, but our policy is for domestic flights. We are to recycle the bottles and cans served in all flights. So that's something that I still is a part of my work today in making sure that, you know, we're sorting in flight and that the infrastructure exists to get it to the right where it needs to go. So that is something that I'm still very proud of. From a product perspective, obviously better is to not generate the waste in the first place, right? And so I'd say that we've done a lot of work in thinking about targeting single-use plastic specifically, because we know that they have very energy intensive, and sometimes some of the products have lower recycling rates. So we had this opportunity, maybe I'll give an example with our transatlantic service, where we had this opportunity to sort of redesign the whole experience, the whole cabin experience. And so that is one where we put sustainability at the top of the list. And so maybe just starting with Mint, which is amazing, by the way. It sounds like you've been on the Boston SFO, I think you said. If you ever have a chance to go on the transatlantic, it's like mind-blowing. I can't believe it. But you'll notice that the food is all reusable. Sorry, the food's not reusable. What am I saying? Strike that part. The utensils and the dishware is all reusable, which is both great from the customer experience, but just not generating trash. And that's actually fairly common in a first-class product, but not in the economy or core. And we did that as well there. So we have this reusable food containers. The amenity kits, both in Mint and in core, are reusable. The kit that we have in core, where I actually use it still at home to like store vegetables and seal it up, like it's an alternative to a plastic bag, essentially. Like that's a super creative new thing that we did. We've removed a lot of single-use plastics, film. So we just, for example, our Eat Up boxes, which is for, you know, network-wide. They used to have this sort of thin plastic film around it that wasn't recyclable. We got rid of all of that. Same for the plastic. We had a plastic jar-shaped cylinder container for our salads on board for our sort of fresh foods, and we just redesigned that so that it's a paper product that is, you know, completely safe, of course, and hygienic, but just completely eliminated that single-use plastic. Because a couple of the things that we're doing, I thought of more, our napkins. That was one that we, a couple of years ago, changed so that it's 100% made of 100% recycled content. It was 60% post-consumer, and we're ramping that up to 100%. So there's still more things on board that we're targeting, for sure. But we are making continuous improvements, and hopefully our customers can see that in the products on board.
So here's an interesting question. You mentioned a lot of things, some of which I was aware of, some I had no clue about. How do you market this to people who are not flying you, to encourage them to actually fly you so that they can fly in a more sustainable fashion today? You mentioned your storytelling video with Neste, but I've, you know, again, that's on the IFE. That's for passengers on board. How do you communicate about this? Because honestly, I didn't know about the JetBlue auto offsetting program as well way later when my team researched into it. And I said, really, I had no idea that JetBlue was doing it. So is this by design that you're keeping quiet about it? How do you market?
Well, you can tell the story as you're doing right now. So that this is step one. I will say that some of the stuff I mentioned it exists in the operation, but it's fairly recent. So I haven't had the opportunity to put it on our website yet or put it in our annual ESG report. I know that that's like the ESG, we have our annual report and we have a whole section usually, including last year, on sustainable product. So it's there, but it's obviously, you know, you have to go digging for it. So I think we can do better at telling the story. And I think this is an interesting topic, the balance of showcasing all of the work that we're doing that we're proud of, but also acknowledging the reality of the impact that we have now. That's true both for our emissions reduction work and for onboard waste, because we've made a lot of progress from the waste and sustainable product side, but there's still things that are on our list to sort of replace still. And I think that we will. It takes time and sort of to source an alternative product. But we're very sensitive, like any company, right? Our biggest fear is being accused of greenwashing, because it undoes all of the work that is so well-intentioned and so authentic that we have to always take a step back and say, okay, I want to tell everyone about this work, but I also don't want to like appear as if we're at 100% sustainable today. We're not. And we know that. And so I think that for a lot of airlines and companies, especially right now, are maybe holding themselves back a little bit, just so we don't get criticized.
Right. And that is a fair point. The interesting thing is, I was speaking to an airline CEO recently whom I asked a similar question. You know, why don't you talk about your efforts? And his immediate response was, have you seen what happened to KLM? So yes, I think people are being cautious in the industry talking about it. And there's some way to go. Storytelling is definitely a key thing. Now, to close up, I mean, we've covered so many aspects. There are two more questions I have specifically around this. One is around JetBlue Ventures. JetBlue, of course, started and spun off JetBlue Ventures, but JetBlue Ventures is working with companies that are working with other airlines as well. It's not necessarily JetBlue's own competitive advantage. In fact, there are companies JetBlue Ventures has invested in which are working with other airlines even before JetBlue comes on board. How is that still working out? How is your relationship with JetBlue Ventures? How involved are you in some of their clean tech, green tech investments? And are you usually, you know, the first in line to say yes or no to a new investment that they make to be a pilot user?
Great. Let me take a step back and at least speak from my perspective about our sort of relationship and division of work. So first of all, I work very, very closely with everybody at JetBlue Ventures. I think practically in my world, I probably am a little more focused on the more immediate term. I'm looking for SAF that's, you know, commercially available today, changes to our onboard product right now. And they are looking, you know, for future technology for a little bit, right? And there's plenty of overlap. First, I'll say that, you know, because I'm sure when you interview them, they're maybe more modest. They're extremely, extremely smart. Their ability to sort of understand the technical limitations and opportunities on emerging technologies, you know, really going deep into sort of the supply chain and the different challenges and price pressures on different technologies that are emerging is really impressive. And so I learn a lot from them, and our work is complementary. In terms of, you know, working with other airlines, so I think that they would, of course, give you the best answer. So for sure, ask them. But what I've seen is we love it, honestly. You know, I mean, look, I think JBV has been pretty clear that when they're investing in something, we want it to be relevant to travel, obviously, in that this is, you know, this is the world in which JetBlue operates, and we want innovations, and we want to, you know, focus our efforts there. But it doesn't have to necessarily be something that's going to be in our operation. We love when it has that opportunity, but really anything that touches our operation, you know, Joby is an excellent example where there's a real obvious connection. And then we saw the partnership with Delta. This is wonderful. This is a portfolio company of ours. Their success is our success as an industry success. So I don't really see any issue there. And just sort of holistically, as we think about the competition, I'm saying it in quotes for the recording part, you know, we like the sustainability folks. There's not a whole lot of us in aviation. We all know each other. We all obviously are competitive. We work for different companies. But I genuinely believe when I see any announcement related to sustainability from another airline, it's a good thing for the industry. I know all my leaders see it. I know they're thinking, ooh, should we have done that? Or, you know, just it gets them to think about it more. And I see the rising tide lifts all ships. So truly, say another airline comes out with an announcement, we're all congratulating them. So that's where we are.
I think that's been one of the most encouraging signs I have been seeing as I speak with multiple heads of sustainability at airlines, multiple airline CEOs. I see this thing about let's raise the bar together. Let's, you know, the rising tide will raise all the boats. And that's very, very encouraging. I think we're going to have a compounding effect in the industry. And you mentioned how the sustainability folks within the industry are closely linked together. interestingly, you're one of the few who actually has a sustainability degree. You studied sustainability when it was not cool. You've been at JetBlue for almost 10 years, if I'm not wrong, doing sustainability, not, you know, doing comms and then corporate affairs and then marketing and now sustainability. You have been doing this. This has been your thing for a decade only at JetBlue. And even before that, I'm curious, what's been your career path? What led you here? How did you get here?
Thank you, by the way, for that call. I didn't even realize that was true. And I guess that means sustainability is cool now. So good to know. You're right. I mean, environmental action is my whole life. My background originally is in climate change research, the sort of outside of working at Cold Stone Creamery, which is really fun. The first like real full-time job that I had was working over at Stanford in their Climate Change Institute, studying how wildlife was impacted by warming climate. And so I was very interconnected with the academic community. And this was back in 2010, I think. I remember part of my job was I was working on a meta-analysis, which is basically a study of studies. And I was reading hundreds of studies and taking out data. And I remember every single article had the same introduction where they were like, climate change is really bad. And here's how much we've warmed and all the bad things. And here's a study about this specific species of bird and why it's impacted. And I had this like moment one day where I was just like, I cannot read another one of these. Like, it's bad and here's more evidence of it. And so I decided I needed to do something about it. And that was that we need people studying the problem. I just knew my passion and path was to go do something about it. And I didn't know what that was yet. I didn't really know so much about business sustainability. My background was all in the sciences. So I spent 2 years working in science communication. I worked for an open access science research publisher. I loved it because it like spoke to this interest in bringing the public free and peer-reviewed scientific information. I could give you like a whole another interview on publishing fees, which I think is the worst. We've all been there when you want to read an article and you have to pay $36 and then you don't read it, right? Sorry. But like I do think that in terms of bringing like from a scientific perspective, I think is different from media, but from a scientific perspective, when there's like especially government funded, research should be available. Anyway, I've absolutely veered off track. So it just wasn't my passion, right? Climate change. I needed to be in the sustainability space. I found a 2-year program. There's now so many of them. I think at the time there were like 5 that I saw in the US, and it was specifically studying business sustainability. So classes in the business school and then classes in the environmental school, learning about the science, and then ended up on the sustainability team at JetBlue in 2014. And I took 1 year off at one point, but for the most part have sort of like sunk my claws in and never left because there's truly no place like it. The work is so fulfilling. And I think, what do I want to say? You know, for as much as I'm concerned about the climate crisis, and I know that's my passion, I've also fallen in love with aviation and travel. I've explored the world. I've seen the good that comes from it. And I view that it's my job to help protect our business and allow us to grow and deliver on our mission. And some of that, big part of that hinges on our ability to actually decarbonize.
Thank you so much. I think that is such an inspiring journey, by the way. And I hope the listeners of the podcast are inspired to themselves venture here. The last bit of this interview is something a bit more fun, where everyone gets to know you a bit more personally. It's called the rapid fire round, in which we will start with something simple and I'll throw a curveball. What is your favorite non-US airline?
Wait, give me a second. Because I... Okay, so... look, I my sister lived in the UAE for several years, so I had the pleasure of flying Emirates, and... the experience is pretty incredible. I haven't been in one of those like cool the first class that you see in all those like TikToks and
the showers, you know, the one that Jennifer Aniston flies.
That's right. So not yet. Maybe one day. Maybe if somebody from Emirates hears this podcast and wants to gift me some tickets, that would be wonderful. But I just like love the concept of thinking about doing things differently, and like that's something that resonates very much with us at JetBlue.
Fantastic. I'm glad to hear. I remember living in Boston when JetBlue was nascent, and I remember this campaign all over the key in Boston, which says flying is for pigeons.
Right.
No clue what it just says pigeons. It didn't have JetBlue logo. It just said flying is for pigeons. And then it said welcome to jetting. I'm sure Morgan, who's listening to this, is probably nodding vigorously at this at this point, and it said, "Welcome to Jetting," and then you had the full can of soda. And those are my early memories. So I absolutely know what you're talking about in terms of differentiated travel experience. Emirates does it well, gets it right internationally. What about your favorite book, Sarah?
Okay, I'm going to be biased here. I'm looking up at the books that I have. I skipped this part in my whole About Me section, but actually, my uncle was a big climate scientist, and so this is actually who I worked for him and his wife at Stanford. So this is actually how I got my start, but I also grew up in this world, and I keep the books that he wrote. He's since passed away, but I think Science as a Contact Sport was something was one of his books that always guided me, and it was, I mean, he was like in the 70s, like one of the first, like, hey, like, look at some of the science that happens when you inject a bunch of CO2 into the atmosphere. And like the topic became obviously very politicized very early on. And he talked about like the importance of science communication, something I'm sure that is something that resonates with you, where he noticed that the academic community was like kind of not very good at talking about and making climate change make sense. I think we've actually come so far, which is really important. And at the same time, it was just the importance around like talking to journalists and making everything digestible. And that's something I think about a lot, is like, I'm, you know, from the beginning a scientist, but like if we can't communicate to anyone, then we've lost.
That's a very interesting one. On that, I actually have a follow-up. Is there a book on sustainability or climate science that you often recommend to beginners who are just starting out?
So funny. I mean, I've got like some I'd hate to say the word boring, for who, I'm sure there's an author out there who hopefully isn't listening. No, I mean, I refer to this Energy for Sustainability textbook that I have from grad school that brings me back to the basics, you know, that I think are really important. Maybe I need to refresh some of mine, but a lot of great, like, just, I have the Sustainable MBA is one that I read early on, just about thinking about the basics of making the business case for sustainability. And I've got some books about wildlife, obviously, and climate change. So, but there's plenty out there.
Fantastic.
Beyond yours.
Thank you. This is always helpful for listeners who are just starting out. What's your favorite city, Sarah?
You know what? I'm surprised that San Diego. I'm from San Diego. My lovely parents are still there. I live in New York City, but every time I'm there, I wonder why I left San Diego. but it's beautiful.
To make flying better.
Thank you. That's right. That's why. Thank you.
What's your favorite movie?
Oh, gosh. I should give... How honest do I want to be? I am really bad at watching movies, and I don't want to pick anything that's like smart and environmental. This is very strange, but my sister and I loved the movie Labyrinth with David Bowie. You look so confused.
Labyrinth?
Was it from the 80s? It was something we watched a lot and something we still like to sing. It was a very bizarre, sort of fantastical. I'm going to go with that since I haven't watched a movie in a long time.
The Labyrinth. We'll take that. What is something you still want to learn?
Oh my goodness. You know, I want to learn everything about JetBlue and this industry. Was that too ambitious? I think everything we do is so fantastic. I never, you know, I see my future in sustainability forever, but also like the more I spend here, the more I'm enamored and just like learning about how we make decisions around, you know, what planes we're going to buy and where we're going to fly to and like different marketing tactics, like just extremely vague. But like I sometimes wish I could just show up in random meetings across the office and just listen and be like, oh, is that what you're talking about? That's so fascinating. So
have you attended JetBlue University?
Of course. I did orientation like 3 or 4 times.
There you go. I hear it's one of the highlights for anyone joining JetBlue. What do you do in your free time?
Okay, so I play kickball in Central Park. I'm on several leagues. Surprisingly to many people, I'm a massive NFL fan. So my husband and I are season ticket holders for the Buffalo Bills. So if anyone from there hears this podcast, please reach out to me for a partnership on field tickets. That would make my life. And they're totally going to win the Super Bowl this year. I can feel it. Obviously, we travel, you know. I mean, that's a huge part of working in this industry. Going to the many places, meeting the crew members all across our network. And so my husband and I are so lucky to be able to take advantage of that.
Slightly personal question. Do you offset your own personal flights?
Well, now that the program ended, so sometimes I probably should go back and at the end of the year, now that this program ended, I probably will. I do though, when I come across, when a company like Etsy, for example, says, or I think actually they already offset your emissions, but say you're looking, you're closing out a purchase and they always say, do you want to contribute? I always do it because I know I see the data on my end and I want them to know that customers care.
Right. And finally, what is the best advice you've received?
Best advice I received? You know, I'm going to make it about JetBlue and sustainability. Rather than, could have gone a couple different directions. I remember something that Robin, our CEO, said to us, and this was at a time when he was serving as the sort of chair of the board of IATA, that global trade association. So he was thinking much bigger than JetBlue. And he sort of said, anything that we do, it's going to go so much farther if we do it together versus ourselves. And it's very tempting as airlines, you know, and we of course do it as well. We're so excited to be like, JetBlue is doing this and alone. But I think the customers and the public sort of looks at airlines holistically and they make a judgment around, are we good actors? Are we bad actors? And obviously, you know, they like the experience and other, you know, and have loyalty to different brands, of course. But I think when you think of it from an environmental standpoint, it's sort of like we're sort of one sort of mass of like good or bad. And so he really helped me think like truly, you know, how do we break down some of these barriers? And how do we do things together? Because that's what people are noticing, not like, oh, JetBlue's incrementally better than, you know, some other airline.
Sarah, thank you so much. You've been so open, so frank. I have learned a lot. I'm incredibly excited about JetBlue's journey. Thank you for sticking your neck out once again, leading the industry as one of the few, I think less than 5 airlines in the world that have set a 2040 target, not a 2050, not a 2060 target. I think the industry is watching you with their eyes peeled and hopefully on this podcast with their ears peeled as well, listening carefully on what they can do, what pitfalls to avoid. This has been extremely enriching for me. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and thank you for sharing our stories and illuminating this. And hopefully you have some software to slow down my voice because I talk so fast and I realize that.
You are a typical New Yorker right now, no longer from the San Diego side of
Oh, all right. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Sustainability in the Air. Aviation is one of the hardest to decarbonize industries, yet there are multiple paths to get to net zero. Awareness is key to a green future. So please give us your support to help our sustainable aviation insights reach a wider audience. You can do this by sharing this episode on your network, on LinkedIn, Twitter, or even WhatsApp. Or perhaps you might consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to this episode. You can start a conversation with us by writing to us at podcast@simplifying.com. And for more content on sustainable aviation, please visit our website, green.simplifying.com, and join the movement. Sustainability in the Air is an original podcast by Simplifying. The show is produced by Juraj Toth in Slovakia. Dirk Singer is our Director of Sustainability, who leads research for each interviewee out of Greenwich, UK. Shubhadeep Pal is our Supervising Editor based out of Mumbai and Singapore. The articles are written by Ayushi Badola in Dehradun in India and Meera Hull in Montreal, Quebec. Creative design is led by Ligia Esteve in Montreal. Baiba Dreamen is the project director for the show based out of Valencia, Spain. Special thanks to Wendy Sim in Singapore. And I'm Shashank Nigam, the CEO of Simplifying and your host. Please feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn.